By the way, you know who wrote that? Who wrote Amazing Grace? It wasn't an Adventist. Who was it? John Newton, the former slave man. John Newton. Now, John Newton was also the author of the words to that hymn, Safely Through Another Week. That lovely Sabbath hymn that we sang last night, that our Sabbath-keeping pioneers like to sing. Now, that's very interesting, because John Newton never was a Seventh-day Adventist. John Newton lived in England. He was pastor of a big church west of London, in Olney. He wrote a lot of hymns called the Olney Hymns. And he was a devout Sabbath keeper on Sunday. And that hymn, Safely Through Another Week, it sings about the beauty of Sabbath. And Sabbath is a symbol of everlasting life and grace and all. Just sing about Sunday. Did you know that? Are you ever going to sing it again? Oh, good. I'm glad. He said, sure. All right. Now, you see, first of all, there were the Catholics, the people, the general circumstance of people in Europe in late medieval times. They had 200 holy days. Sunday made up 50 of them, and then they had another 150 holy days besides. People can't keep 200 holy days. So they all became holidays. You go to church in the morning if you can, and then the afternoon you don't do anything very serious, but you can't keep it holy. God didn't make it that way. So when it came to Sabbath, the Catholics had the wrong day, Sunday, and the wrong way, holiday. Well, in the English Reformation, the people you hear laughed at, called Puritans, they're laughed at by the liberals in the church who didn't want to keep Sabbath holy. We shouldn't laugh at the Puritans. We're on their side, really. We're on their side. The Puritans were people in England, mostly in the Church of England at first, who felt that they ought to keep Sabbath holy. They read it in the Bible, the Fourth Commandment. And the Sabbath ought to be kept from sundown to sundown. And they began preaching this, and they made a big row in England around 1600 about the Sabbath question. The Sabbath question was whether to keep the whole day or just the morning holy. See? These people who became the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians and later on the Baptists, these people were Sabbath keepers. Did you realize that? They had the wrong day, but they had the right way. You know the people who came over on the Mayflower, the Pilgrim Fathers, you know they left Holland to get freedom to keep the Sabbath, as they understood it. And in those dreadful winter days when they severely needed to get established, find a place to build houses for themselves in a terrible cold. Half of them did lose their lives that winter because of the rigors of the climate. Every time Sabbath came around, they kept the day holy, the full day. They were Sabbath keepers on the wrong day. They didn't have the mark of the beast. I know they didn't. They were doing the very best they could. Well, when some people are really keeping the wrong day in the right way, somebody is going to ask after a while, maybe we ought to keep it on the right day as well as in the right way. And that's where the Seventh-day Baptists came in. And it was from the Seventh-day Baptists that some of the Adventists learned to keep Sabbath on Sabbath instead of keeping Sabbath on Sunday. And so it came about. But see, when our church got started keeping Sabbath here in New York and New England and around, we didn't have to tell people how to keep Sabbath. They knew how. We didn't really have to tell people they needed to keep Sabbath. Many of them knew they needed to keep it. What we needed to do was tell them what day to keep it on. You won't find much in any of the early Adventist literature on how to keep Sabbath, because they all knew. The Puritans had taught them. And Sister White, when she does start writing about how to keep the Sabbath, she has it pretty much the way the Puritans had defined it, because the Puritans, that's the Presbyterians, the Congregationalists, and the Baptists, in those days, had got their ideas out of the Bible. I could tell you a lot more about that. But yes, sir.
Did they keep Sunday Sabbath from sundown to sundown?
Yes, and sometimes they kept it better than that. They kept it from the middle of Saturday afternoon until Monday morning. No Saturday night movies in their schools. They waited till they got up Sunday on the next day after the Sabbath. I often wonder what we really do teaching our young people to really blow everything on Saturday night. They come home from church and change their clothes, put on their old clothes, and then spend most of Sabbath afternoon phoning their friends and planning Saturday night. That isn't Sabbath keeping. Not really. You know it isn't. And so we need to teach them something better than that so they can enjoy really keeping the Sabbath. See, the Roman Catholics have Mardi Gras. That means Fat Tuesday. Mardi Gras, that's when they really have a blowout just before Lent. And they have the weeks of Lent and then Easter. We have, in many cases, we have Mardi Gras after Lent on Saturday night. Let the kids have a kind of a blowout. I don't think Jesus really likes that. When Jonathan Edwards observed that his young people there in Massachusetts, that his young people were planning parties on Sunday night after the Sunday Vespers, he became very worried and planned a revival for his church. He wanted the young people to keep Sabbath right through until Monday morning. And he seriously planned a revival. It would get those young people not to throw off the holiness of the day so easily. They had a very good revival. It spread all around the area, became famous, and even stimulated things in Britain. It was an attempt to help his young people keep Sabbath better. Sabbath is, you know, holiness, not rest. Do you realize that? Remember the Sabbath day to keep it lazy. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it by the lake. Remember the Sabbath day to rest up for the rest of the week. What does it say? Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. For I gave them my Sabbath, that they might know that I am the one that extends their life. No. I gave them my Sabbath, that they might know that I am the one that helps them get rested up. No. I gave them my Sabbath, that they might know that I am the one who sanctifies them, makes them holy. The purpose of the Sabbath is holiness. It goes on and says not to work on that day. That isn't because the purpose of the Sabbath is to rest. That's because you need time on Sabbath to get holy. The purpose of the Sabbath for us today is to develop Christ-likeness. That's real holiness in preparation for living with Jesus in heaven. In preparation for persuading other people to live in heaven with us, because they see that we are such nice Christians. It is not to rest up. Resting may be part of it, but that isn't the purpose of it. So, dear friend, if somebody asks you to be Sabbath school superintendent for the kindergarten division, and you say, oh, I can't do it, that's the only morning I have to rest up, you completely missed the meaning of the Sabbath, haven't you? You've been asked to come and help those children learn to be like Jesus. And that's the purpose of the Sabbath. So you say, well, I guess I'm going to have to rest up Saturday night, because I'm needed to help young people learn what it means to be holy Sabbath morning. Now that's the way the Puritan people understood Sabbath. They had the right way with the wrong day. Now we, for many years, as Seventh-day Adventists, we've had the right way and the right day. But I fear, and this wasn't in my notes, I'm rambling here, I fear that for many of us we have the right day and the wrong way. We're shifting back in some of our places, are we not, to the holiday idea. Go to church, well, if it's convenient. and then don't do anything serious the rest of the day. Well, that's the way the Catholics keep Sunday, friend. That isn't Sabbath keeping, is it? We haven't thought about it, so now we need to stop and think about it. Think about it and see what is real Sabbath keeping. The right day and the right way. Now, let's see. We are Seventh-day Adventists. Let me go back and discuss with you how we got the name. And we'll come back to Sabbath keeping in a bit. But first of all, we're going to talk about Adventists. Are you an Adventist? Maybe some of you are not. You're visiting. We've had quite a number of visitors come. But those of you who are, hey, welcome, visitors. Adventist. What is an Adventist by definition? An Adventist. Somebody who believes the second coming is going to be soon. Is that right? So, now, an Adventist is a person who believes the second coming is near. Can I turn that one around? A person who believes that the second coming is near is an Adventist? Somebody said no. Well, what's the matter with our definition? We've been testing it out here and didn't quite hold up. Are there people out there, Bible-believing people, church-attending people, Christ-loving people, who believe Christ is coming sooner than some of the Adventists do? Are there? Secret rapture people, they think he might come any minute. And we don't believe that. We think there are some prophecies to be fulfilled first. I was in Australia 10 years ago. They drive on the opposite side of the road there. And this means that the drivers of the cars sit on the other side of the car. And I knew that. And we'd been there for several days, and I'd preached some meetings, and friends were showing me around, and I was off guard a little bit, and we came up at a stop sign. I suddenly had a funny feeling, you know, just for a second. Maybe the secret rapture has happened. There's no driver in the car in front. Well, there was, of course, but he was sitting on the other side, because they drive on the other side. Well, that's just a little funny moment, but those people, And they love Jesus, and they sing joyous songs. They think Christ is coming sooner than we do. Are they Adventists? They don't think they are. So now, what is an Adventist? Person who thinks Christ is coming soon. Well, that definition didn't hold up too well. We better get into it a little deeper. Are you ready? It won't be hard. Who were the first Adventists? Miller's followers, okay? They got to be known as Adventists. But before they were called Adventists, they were called, watch it now, Second Adventists. Second Adventists. That'd be quite a name for us, wouldn't it? Seventh-day Second Adventists. How does that sound? Seventh-day Second Adventists. When our Review and Herald started, it was the Advent Review and Sabbath Herald. Remember that, you old-timers? Okay. But in the very start, it was Second Advent Review, comma, and Sabbath Herald. Second Advent Review. Why Second Advent? Because, to most Christians, the Advent is the first coming. Advent means coming. It's Latin. Ad means towards, and vent, venio, venire, to come or go. Okay. Now, most Protestant churches today observe four Sundays leading up to Christmas as Advent season or Advent. And that's about the first coming of Christ, Christmas. And the ministers, if they wish, will also talk about Christ's second Advent. Now, when Miller began to preach, Miller believed that Christ's advent was his first coming. He was another Protestant, along with all the other Protestants and Catholics, who believed the advent is the first coming, which it is. So when he talked about the second coming of Christ, it was the second advent he was preaching about. Now get this. As his movement spread in the early 1840s, and there were camp meetings and then the big tent meetings and other meetings in auditoriums, these meetings would be announced as Second Advent meetings. Get it? Second Advent meetings. And so the people who attended and who got caught up in the message and tried to win their neighbors to it were known as Second Adventists. Now, they might be Methodists and Baptists, Congregationalists, Episcopalian, because it was an interchurch movement. But insofar as they talked about the second coming of Christ, they would be known as Second Adventists. Now, what was a Second Adventist? A person who believed, get it, listen, that Christ was coming soon because of the fulfillment of the 2300 days. Do you get it? That's obvious. When you stop and think about it, why didn't you think about that yourself? A Second Adventist was a person who believed that Christ was coming soon because of the fulfillment of the 2300 days. Well, you knew that, just hadn't thought about it. That's easy. You've got it now in your head. Now, Second Adventist is quite a long name. I mean, there weren't any First Adventist people around, and there weren't any Third Adventist people around to confuse them with, and so gradually, or rather quickly, really, the term Second was dropped out of Second Adventist, and these people just got to be known as Adventists. And everybody knew that when you said the person was an Adventist, that you really meant he was a Second Adventist. A person who believed that Christ is coming soon in view of the fulfillment of the 2300 days. Now, after the disappointment, those who became Sabbath-keeping Adventists and then Seventh-day Adventists were still appropriately known as Adventists, because they continued to believe that Christ was coming soon in view of the 2300 days. Now, did you know that? Did you realize that? I want you to take it home and ponder it, because that's a fact. We are Adventists because of the 2300 days. We are Adventists because of 1844. I mean, we are. That's how it came about. That's what makes us different. We are Adventists. We believe Christ is coming soon because of the fulfillment of the 2300 days. That's just a fact. I'm teaching you something that I learned I didn't know before I studied it. How come teachers are so much smarter than their students? Well, they just got to study the thing out ahead of them, that's all. You know some things I don't know. You're smarter than I am on those things because you thought about them before I did. We're just all a little smarter than each other on some things because we got to study them out. When I went to the seminary to teach in 1968, I was talking about the sanctuary a bit in the class in Adventist history. A young man near the back of the old room 230, which isn't there anymore, it's been divided in half, put up his hand and said rather arrogantly and irritatedly, "What does the sanctuary have to do with Seventh-day Adventist history?" Oh, I don't think he said it quite that bad, but I think that's what he meant. What does the sanctuary, that's the whole 1844 meaning and everything, what does that have to do with Seventh-day Adventist history? Everything. And I heard myself saying, why, if it wasn't for the sanctuary, that's 1844 and the whole bit, there wouldn't be any Seventh-day Adventist church. That's right. That's right. Now, God would have raised up somebody else, but the fact is that right here in his house, in the east room downstairs in the front, where William Miller studied this book, he was a chosen vessel for that time. There arose an understanding that is really core basis to the existence of our movement today, which is spread around the world beyond anything William Miller ever believed. And he was a Baptist. And he was helped by Church of Christ man, Joshua B. Hines, and Methodist Litch, and Congregationalist Presbyterian Charles Fitch. It's an interchurch movement. God calls anybody. He loves us all. Praise his name. And he's calling people from all those denominations today to come and join. We're not a closed society, brother and sister. We're not a closed society. We're the openest society in the world. We don't only open to everybody who wants to come, but encourage them to come. Join us and help us get this message spread around the world. Now, young people sometimes think, da-dee-da, if 1844 is the reason we think Christ is coming soon, gee, that's a long time ago. How soon is soon? Have you ever heard that? Okay, now, I won't do it because time is short, but one thing I like to is to set up a timeline with living people right out of the audience. But it takes a little time, and I won't do it now because we're trying to cover quite a bit of ground in the time available. But I'll talk about it. You can imagine it and see it in your mind's eye. A timeline extending from the fall of Adam and Eve over there by that nice white canvas wall, 6,000 years right across the tent to the canvas wall on this side. 6,000 years, you get it? And the point is, I'm trying to show that 1844 is right close up against that tent wall. We're crowded into the space between 1844 and that tent wall, the end of time. You want to just imagine it with me a little bit? If I was going to really ask some of you to come up here and help me, like I did in the Battle Creek Church 2 weeks ago, and I've done other places, who would be put right in the middle of our timeline? What Bible character would go right here in the middle?
David.
Who did you say?
David.
David? That's right. David comes right in the middle. Only a boy named David. One little thing. Right here in the middle. 3,000 before and 3,000 after him. Now, if this is the middle, if this is David, then where would we put the cross? Where would we put Jesus? And I'll ask, when I do this properly, I ask somebody to come up and I tell them, everybody, we're all supposed to represent Jesus every day, aren't we? So don't be embarrassed. And so somebody comes up and stands. And I tell them, now when I mention your name, you stretch your arms out so people will know what you represent. And I tell the boy here, when I say your name, you do this, okay? Now, what will we have? Whom will we have? Halfway between David and the cross. That's very famous in Bible prophecy and Adventist Bible studies. Who is it? Right in the middle, huh? Daniel. Daniel, right in the middle. 500 before, 500 after. About 500 BC, more or less. And we'll put 476 on one of his shoulders. That's spreading a little bit. And how will we symbolize him? How about making him look like the Daniel 2 image, okay? With his arms folded. You know why the Daniel 2 image always has his arm folded in the pictures? Well, nobody ever told me this. I just figured it out for myself, okay? It's so that the silver won't get mixed up with the brass. Because if he had his arms hanging down, you know, his hands would still be silver, and it's all supposed to be up here. So I think that's the reason. Gold, silver, and by folding his arms, it makes the picture neater. Okay, so I tell Daniel, when we talk about you, fold your arms like this and pretend you're the Daniel 2 image. But on this shoulder, don't forget, you have 476 BC, which is a little bit past your time, but it has to do. Okay, are you following the picture? Are you with me? Now, where are we going to put, who are we going to put about 500 years before David? Well, don't you know? Moses. And several hundred years before that, Abraham. Abraham's back down here. Between here and Adam and Eve, we've got the flood and all that business. That's 2,000 years. 6,000 years is a long time. About 500 years after the cross, we get the fall of Rome. And you thought that was ancient history. The cross is ancienter. And then 1,000 years before Columbus sailed the ocean blue. You got that pictured way down there? I usually pick a girl for that and tell her to pretend she's Mrs. Columbus. And when I say her name, she's supposed to wave goodbye to Columbus. And then way down there, way past the Declaration of Independence and first the war, Revolutionary War and the War of 1812 and William Miller's battle and all the rest is 1844. 97.5% of Earth's history before 1844. And then when I've got everybody placed, the picturing is, I run back there with my pocket transmitter, see, going, so I don't have wires to bother me. And I go back there and I stand beside Adam and Eve. They're crying because they just sinned and they've driven out of the Garden of Eden. And I'm telling them, come on, Jesus promised you that he would come and die for you. And here's a pair of binoculars from Bausch & Lomb. And if you look down history with me, I think you're going to see Jesus dying. So come on, comfort yourselves, Adam, Eve, and let's look for Jesus. And I give them a pair each and we start looking, okay? And we look. And we look. And we look. And we look for almost 1,000 years. And then almost 2,000 years. And we've only got as far as the flood. And then Abraham. Oh, Abraham's offering his son Isaac. And God is saying, you don't need to do it. I'll provide a sacrifice. And I quick tell Adam and Eve what that means. And they feel better. Jesus is going to die for them. So they don't have to die for themselves. They feel a bit better. But they want to see Jesus. And so we go on another 500 years. And there's Moses leading people through the Red Sea. And I tell them, quick, that means God is still caring for his people, working miracles for them. See, God is love. You believe that, Adam. Believe that, Eve. And they feel a little better, but we've only gone 2,500 years. 2,500. And then we come down, I say, then we come down to the time of David. And David does what I told him to do, see, and starts doing this. So everybody remembers that's David right in the middle. And that's only halfway. And then we get down to Daniel with his prophecies of the coming of the Messiah. And then, after 4,000 years, there he is! There's Jesus! And the man puts his hands out like this, and Adam and Eve just burst into tears of joy, and they're so happy and so sad that their death caused Jesus. Well, that's great for Adam and Eve and great for us, but we're looking for 1844 and the second coming, aren't we? And our Bausch & Lomb binoculars aren't nearly good enough, and we pick up some expensive telescopes. It's going to be a long look. We go on another 500 years. That's twice the age of the United States, friends, before we get to the fall of Rome. Ancient history after the cross. You think of that. And then we're on our own for 1,000 years. And there's Mrs. Columbus waving goodbye, 1492. Her husband's going off to sail the ocean blue. And we still look. If the day is getting late, as we go on past 1776, and the clouds are coming up in the sky, the day is going to be over, and we haven't found 1844 yet. And then a cry goes out from our hearts. There they are, the three angels flying in the sunset. Oh, God, thank you. And as we look very, very, very carefully, we see underneath the three angels a marble column with the words in the letters engraved on them in gold, 1844. And as we do that, the young man who's standing there, representing 1844, lets out a shout. The hour of his judgment is come. Have you got the picture? 1844 is way down there beside that tent wall, friends. We are in the end of time. We are in the time of the end. 1798 is another sign, end of 1260 days. I tell people this shoulder of that fellow represents 1798, the end of the 1260 days, and this shoulder represents 1844, the end of the 2300 days. That's the time of the end. Now, when did the 2300 days begin? 457 B.C. You can remember that. That's the seventh year of Artaxerxes. And it's in chapter 7 of Ezra. Chapter 7 of Ezra, the seventh year of Artaxerxes, is the beginning of the 70 weeks. Oh, you can't forget that. 457 B.C. And how can anybody forget that? You'd have to work hard to forget that. Take the easy way. Just remember it. The seventh chapter of Artaxerxes, the seventh year of Artaxerxes, the seventh chapter of Ezra, the beginning of the 70 weeks, 2300 days, in 450, what? 7 B.C. Now, in Great Controversy, page 457. Are you no kidding? This is right. Great Controversy, page 457. It's true. I'll make it easy to remember, all right? Great Controversy, page 457. Sister Wright says that the calculations which led to the understanding that the 2300 days would end in the fall of 1844 stand without impeachment. under inspiration, she fully endorsed this calculation. Now, on the next page, what would the next page be after 457? 458. On page 458, she says this. If all those who, I'm not quoting it exactly right, but almost like this. If all those who had believed the first angel's message had preached the third angel's message about the Sabbath, God would have wrought mightily with their efforts. The world would have been warned, and Christ would have come years ago. That is not an exact quote, but that's what she said. You're familiar with that. Great Controversy, page 458. Yeah, I better read it to you so I have it right. Okay, 458. If all who had labored unitedly in the work of 1844 had received the third angel's message, and proclaimed it in the power of the Holy Spirit, the Lord would have wrought mightily with their efforts. A flood of light would have been shed upon the world. Years ago, the inhabitants of the earth would have been warned, the closing work completed, and Christ would have come for the redemption of his people. And she wrote this no later than 1884. How many people, how many Millerites were there that preached the midnight cry, the first angel's message, united in the work of 1844? How many were there? Nobody knows. Miller said 50,000. Dr. Dick of Union College, in his dissertation in 1930, calculated from various evidences 150,000. Supposing we say somewhere more than 100,000. Nobody kept records because these people belonged to all the different churches. If all of them had preached the Sabbath, only about 200 of them preached the Sabbath. You realize that? Out of 100,000 or more, too bad. It wasn't until the 1920s that God had as many people preaching the angels' messages as he had in the 1840s. What a pity. By that time, the population of the world had just about doubled, and it's going to be more difficult. But it's coming along now, and I'm happy about that. So, somebody, why are you an Adventist? What does it mean to be an Adventist? A person who believes that Christ is coming soon because of the Trinity on this. There are other reasons, but that's what makes it different. Friends, is the investigative judgment a part of the final judgment? Is the investigative judgment part of the final judgment? Yes or no? Well then, the final judgment began in 1844. Say that again. The final judgment has already begun. Almost all Christians who ever think about the end of the world and the second coming and the final judgment, the end of the world, the second coming and the final judgment, think it's the same thing. And they think it'll happen someday. Most Christians have some idea there's going to be a judgment someday. Our job, our privilege, whatever, is to go out and tell people, friends, the final judgment has already begun. Any questions there? I want to go into why we're Sabbath keepers next, tying back with what we were talking about, the Puritans and these other people. Yes, sir? William Miller never accepted the third angel's message about the Sabbath. That is true. And he was a devout Sabbath keeper on Sunday, however. And it's very interesting that when T.M. Preble wrote the tract about the seventh-day Sabbath that won Joseph Bates, when T.M. Preble, a Baptist, wrote the tract about the true seventh-day Sabbath that converted Joseph Bates to be a Sabbath keeper, T.M. Preble quoted extensively from a sermon by William Miller on the Sabbath, meaning Sunday.
because Miller was a devout believer that you should keep the Sabbath and how you should keep it, and that it was not nailed to the cross. So William Miller's Sabbatic Sunday nonetheless was used by God to help people keep the true Sabbath on the true day. Did you follow that? You come and take the class from me and I'll give you a copy of that tract. You can read it. Okay? Another question? Yes, sir? My brother?
God was clearly in this great awakening, religious awakening.
Yes.
Why did he allow them to misunderstand about the sanctuary, and he could have prevented a disappointment perhaps?
Why didn't God prevent the disappointment when he knew in advance that it was going to happen? Have you ever wondered about that? If you haven't really thought about the whole business. Sure, we've all wondered that, haven't we? Why did God let it happen? Why didn't God just leave Miller in his study, studying? That's what Miller wanted. Miller didn't want to preach the Trinity 100 days. And for 13 years, he managed to keep God off his back. Or try to. It was because God pestered him patiently but perseveringly that Miller finally gave in and said, okay, God, if you really want me to do it, I'll do it. So we have a deeper question. Why didn't God prevent the disappointment? And that is to ask, why did God fuss with Miller in the first place? Well, because something big was going to happen and people needed to know about it. You know, Sister White says in Great Controversies, down around 488, somewhere down there, in the chapter on investigative judgment, unless we clearly understand the sanctuary ministry of Christ, unless we clearly understand it, we cannot exercise the faith essential at this time. You know that? How many sermons in righteousness by faith that you've heard preached lately talk about the sanctuary in heaven? Some, I hope. But if you haven't, those are not real righteousness by faith sermons. Because they don't teach the right kind of faith. Unless we understand, we're told. Unless we understand, well, why were we given this message if it wasn't because we needed it? We need to understand the sanctuary message in its plainest, simplest, most direct way in order to exercise the kind of faith essential at this time. So evidently people need to know something was going to happen. Now, listen, brother. A moment ago, I showed you that when Hiram Edson and Joseph Turner and Apollos Hale and Enoch Jacobs and others of the brethren scattered in different places found out what really happened in heaven, that the wedding happened there, not on the earth, they found it in Luke 12:35-37. That the Son of Man was to come in the clouds of heaven to the ancient days, not to the earth, they found that answer where it's written, in Daniel 7:13. And so with other texts. So, where was the solution to the disappointment? In the Bible. When was Daniel 7:13 written? Roughly 500 BC, let's say. Had God provided the answer? Yes, 2,300 years. When did Jesus talk about waiting till the Lord returns from the wedding? About the year 30 AD, 31. That was 1,800 years and something before the disappointment. The answer had been there, so God really tried. He had it in here. He even called William Foy, the black Baptist lay preacher, and gave him some visions, which indicated that time was to go on. And they didn't understand. I think Myron Whitman is going to talk about this tonight, so I don't want to steal his thunder, except if you hear something twice from two different people, it stays in your mind better. When Jesus explained the disappointment of the cross to his disciples that Sunday afternoon on the way to Emmaus, where did he find the explanation of the cross? Where? In the Bible. It had been there. These folks had memorized those texts in synagogue school. All these promises of the Messiah, they knew them. They didn't understand them. Well, then, Jesus knew they didn't understand. And yet he had that triumphal entry, and he knew they, when they said, here comes the king, that they thought he was going to kill the Romans and make Jerusalem the capital of the world. Jesus knew that. So why didn't he stop? Can you imagine? Jesus there on his donkey. If you ever see a person riding on a donkey, it looks kind of silly, but because the legs stick straight out like this. Okay. Because the donkey isn't shaped properly for human beings. But among the Jews, that was very symbolic, to ride on a donkey. Because they weren't supposed to ride on horses, because horses are for war, and donkeys were for peace. So a person who rode on a donkey would be a symbol of a peaceful ruler. So Jesus rode on a donkey, not on a horse, and he said, "Hail him comes King of the Jews." All right? Now, why didn't Jesus stop right there, sitting on his donkey, and say, like the Pharisees told him to, "Tell your people not to do this," the Pharisees said. Now, this would be one time Jesus could have really cooperated with the Pharisees. And he could have said, "People, stop it. I got to tell you something. Please, be quiet." Well, they would have got quiet after a while, waiting for the big pronouncement, you know. "I am about to go into Jerusalem and drive out the Romans." So they would have listened to him. And supposing instead of saying that, he said, "You're wrong. I'm not going to be the kind of king you want me to be. Friday afternoon before Sabbath, I'm going to be killed and put on a cross. And then on Sunday morning, I'm going to come back to life again." Would they have believed him? Would they? Probably not. Listen, Jesus said that to his 12 disciples, who had every reason to believe in him. And did they believe it? Peter said to Jesus, "Now Jesus, don't be paranoid. This won't happen to you." The New Testament tells us that 3 times Jesus told the disciples in so many words, expressly, explicitly, that he was going to Jerusalem to suffer many things at the hands of the scribes and Pharisees, that he would be killed and would rise again the 3rd day, and the disciples didn't believe it. Well then, why didn't Jesus just skip the whole triumphal entry? Then there wouldn't have been any disappointment. Because Jesus knew that on Friday afternoon, on 2 pieces of rough wood outside the walls of old Jerusalem, he was going to participate in an act of atonement so vitally important, not only to the world but to the universe, that everybody needed to know about it who could ever know about it, because whosoever believeth in him might not perish but have everlasting life. And so he did the best he could with the people that he had. He even sent the disciples out to preach, "The kingdom of God is at hand," though he knew, the disciples thought, when they said "kingdom of God," that they meant a military kingdom. He sent them out anyway, did the best he could. Poor Jesus. Even after the crucifixion and the resurrection and the miracles and the miraculous appearances, and the disciples are with Jesus all again, and they don't realize he's about to leave and go back to heaven. Do you know what they said to him? "Are you going to set up your kingdom now?" If there was ever a time when Jesus must have felt frustrated, it would have to be right then. And all he could say was, "I can't explain to you the times and seasons." He tried. "You tarry in Jerusalem until you be endued with power from above. And then you go out." I want you to start right here in Jerusalem where you're persecuted. Start right here where they persecute you. Start in the hardest place first. Get practice. And then go out to Samaria and then the ends of the earth. So in 1844, Jesus knew that in the most holy place of the heavenly sanctuary, on October 22, 1844, 10th day, 7th month, the Day of Atonement, he was going to participate in an act of atonement so vital to the success of the whole universe and the great controversy that everybody in the world who could possibly be called to know about it should know about it. So those who believe can exercise the kind of a faith that is essential at this time. So God did his best. That's a long answer to your question, but you see, you got me on a hobby of mine, and so I went off. Yes, I believe that. Are you the same man that asked the question before? I thought I had you settled.
One further question.
All right. No, it says he put his hand over a certain calculation on the 1843 chart and kept them from getting that figured out. So, no, not the sanctuary truth as a whole. But anyway, you know, the whole principle, did Jesus tell the disciples there are some things I want to tell you, but you can't bear them now? Too much light blinds. You ever drive along the highway at night and this stupid fellow comes at you with his halogen lamps on as well as his other beams, all four of them on high? What's the matter with that guy? He's blinding me with light. Too much light blinds. So God lets us learn step by step as our minds can take it. Brother?
But is it true his followers did not finish harvest? And then they clothed in the white clothes. Is it true that?
Okay, there were three things there. The miller didn't keep the Sabbath. That's true. His followers dressed in white robes awaiting the second coming. That's false. But that some did not harvest their crops. That's true. Some did not harvest their crops. That's right. The most famous story is about the man in Hastings. No, Leonard Hastings, who didn't harvest his potato crops. And his neighbors came and offered to dig them for him. And he said, no, I've decided to leave them in the ground as a witness to my faith that Christ is coming soon and I won't need those potatoes. Now it happened that a blight developed on the potatoes that were dug on time, and the whole crop was wiped out. And when Mr. Hastings, some weeks later, went out to dig his potatoes, he found them solid and good. And they stayed good until spring, and he was able to share them with his neighbors and help them get started again on their potato crop. That's a nice story about that crop, anyway, of potatoes. Yes, brother?
The great disappointment, all these things were prophesied in the Bible.
Yes.
Due to the great disappointment, I think, in Revelation 10:10, where you have the eating of the book,
the little book was sweet in the mouth and bitter in the belly.
Well, is that also that kind of,
yes,
goes along with Luke and all these different places?
That's right. It was predicted that there would be a disappointment. Now, the Millerite Adventists didn't evidently catch on to that right away, but they did in time, that the very disappointment itself, just like the death of Christ itself, had been predicted. And thus the death of Jesus confirmed the messiahship of Jesus, not the opposite. And the disappointment confirmed the Millerite movement, not the opposite. That's good. Yes, that's fine. Revelation 10. Sister over here. Miller died not knowing the Sabbath.
I've only been an Adventist a year and a half.
Oh, I'm so glad you're here.
And that was my understanding, that Miller got this all started, the Sabbath.
All right. In a way he did, but in a roundabout way. William Miller got the true attention to the 2300 days and 1844, and that the judgment was datable to 1844, and that Jesus would go into the most holy place in 1844. Now, that was a big lot. Now, Miller didn't personally keep the Sabbath. He kept Sunday as a Sabbath. And remember I told you he was old in his 60s. And his mental powers were not as keen as they had been. It was amazing that Miller clung to his faith in the second coming in spite of it. He thought he made a mistake in his early date. Not 457, that must have been wrong, but some other date. And the 20 other days would end soon. And so Miller set a new date today, until he comes, for whom my soul yearns. That was good. So Miller showed no bitterness, great compassion to his people and to others who criticized him and laughed at him. And he kept Sunday on Sabbath devoutly, and the Lord accepted his earnestness because he had given so much of himself to serve God. And we're told that angels guard that grave down there. You ought to be there before you leave here. But now, before we quit I must quickly show you how the Sabbath is related to 1844. I can do it in just a few minutes, although it's good if it takes an hour to do it. Yes, sir? One more.
I just wrote down several short things what God accomplished purposes for 1844. See if you would agree.
What did God accomplish in the 1844 movement and message, all right? Number
one. It proclaims Jesus coming.
Proclaims Jesus coming.
Two, brought a test.
Brought a test. Separated sheep from the goats at that time. Three.
Three, revealed a spiritual condition.
Revealed people's spiritual condition.
And it brought to a decision.
Yes.
And then it separated two classes.
Well, you've had that one already. That's good, though. That same idea of decision and separation. Go on.
Revealed a need for preparation.
Revealed people's need for preparation. That's good.
And purified the church.
Purified the church. Okay, but you can also add to that the information about the judgment beginning in heaven and the sanctuary ministry of Christ. Call people's attention. Wait up just 1 second, sister. Let me give me 5 minutes on that and I'll show you how the Sabbath fits in. By the way, another book you're supposed to get before you go home is this book here called Magnificent Disappointment. It's got kind of a silly cover on it. It looks like a Hallmark card. You won't think it's a serious book, but it is. And in there I explain a lot of these things. The magnificent disappointment. The black cloud of the disappointment had a silver lining so bright that it can be called a magnificent disappointment. You really understood what happened. And the magnificence is what Jesus began to do and did. Magnificent disappointment. What's the name of it? Okay, they've got some in the book of Bible. You borrow some. Go in with somebody else. Borrow one. Xerox it in the library. What I want you to do is read it. You'll know why you're Seventh-day Adventist. I mean, I've been teaching this in the seminary for 20 years. I've got something I'd like to tell you. I'd like you to read it. I believe it'll make you a better Adventist. That's my goal. Okay, now, real quick. Revelation 11, 19. What was that? Revelation 11, 19. Good for you. That's the last verse in chapter 11. It leads right into chapters 12, 13, and 14, where Revelation 12, 17, the remnant, keep the commandments of God. Revelation 14, 12, the saints, keep the commandments of God. Revelation 11, 19 is the introduction to chapters 12 to 14. You read all about that in the book, God Cares. A lot of you have God Cares. Did you catch this? In that book, okay, when Mrs. White talks in the Great Controversy about the Sabbath, her very first text is Revelation 11, 19. It is. What does Revelation 11, 19 say? The temple of God was opened in heaven, and the ark of His testament was seen, and there were thunders and voices and lightnings and an earthquake and great hail. What in the world does that mean? The temple in heaven had already been opened up to John in the book of Revelation. He'd seen in the holy place, in heaven's vast holy place, he had seen what was equivalent to the seven golden candlesticks. He had seen in there the golden altar. He had seen the throne in the holy place where the Father and the Son sit, which I call the table of showbread. But now, for the first time, as we approach chapters 12 to 14 on the Great Controversy, as we approach chapters 12 to 14 dealing with the Great Controversy, climaxing with the commandment keepers to introduce chapters 12 to 14, John is shown for the first time inside the most holy place where the Ark of the Testament is seen. That introduces, that sets the theme for chapters 12 to 14, a view now of the most holy place where the Ten Commandments are. We know from Revelation 11, 19 that chapters 12 to 14 are going to focus on commandment keeping, the Sabbath question in the last days. Now, when Joseph Bates, with his first tract on the Sabbath, traveled all the way to Port Gibson to meet Hiram Edson, who had written about the heavenly sanctuary, as these two men talked together, they suddenly began to see that maybe Revelation 11:19 really did apply to today. Because Jesus has just opened up the most holy place where the Ten Commandments are, is now the time for a new emphasis on the Sabbath. Joseph Bates had already become a Sabbath keeper since the disappointment. He knew of several other people would just become Sabbath keepers since the disappointment. Is it possible? He got so excited. He came back from Port Gibson, traveling, by the way, all the way by water to the coast of Massachusetts, along the Erie Canal, down the Hudson River, around the coast, back home. By water, all the way. Back home. Got out a second edition of his little book, Seventh-day Sabbath, the Perpetual Sign. And in the preface, the second preface now, because this is the second edition, came out in January 1847, he quoted Revelation 11:19 and asked, is it possible that the new interest in the Sabbath is occasioned by Christ having just recently entered the most holy place? I'm not sure of this, but I can't see what else it means. Now, the first edition of that little book had converted James and Ellen White, newly married, to the Sabbath in September. Now it's January. Mrs. White, James White, have been Sabbath keepers now for a few months. January, February, March 6, 1847. James and Ellen White are visiting Joseph Bates in Fairhaven. Sister White has a vision, which she had again, same vision, a month later, April 3, 1847. And we tell you about the one of April 3. Because immediately after the one of April 3, well, by Wednesday, April 7, she wrote to Joseph Bates an account of that vision, same vision she had in March 6. And Joseph Bates hurried with that letter to the printer and had it printed on one side of a sheet of paper called A Vision. And if you were in the seminary taking a class from me, I'd give you a copy of that so you could keep it and read it, and I could test you on it. Okay. She says, and she came out of the vision, and they asked her, can you tell us about the vision? Sometimes she couldn't. This time she could. And she said, an angel came flying swiftly towards me. He bore me in his arms to heaven. Now, come on, I can explain this to you, but our time's running out. I saw a large building. He took me inside the building, and there was Jesus waiting for me. He pulled the veil aside, and we went into the holy place. Now, this is the miniature model of the heavenly sanctuary that Sister White refers to in Spiritual Gifts. Evidently, there's a model in heaven just like the one on the earth. And Moses was told to build his sanctuary according to the model, the pattern, the type shown him, not according to the full real one. That's another subject. But anyway, point is, Jesus took her through into the most holy place in this vision. You can read it. Life Sketches, page 100. You read it right there. Life Sketches, page 100. And Jesus took her into the most holy place of this model sanctuary in heaven. And there was the ark and Aaron's rod that budded in the pot of manna. And Jesus lifted up the tables of the law, which were folded together like a book. That's interesting. And opened them up. And the first four commandments I saw shone brighter than the other six. And the fourth commandment shone brightest of them all. It was all over glorious. It had a halo of glory around it. And then as she goes on describing the vision, she said, I saw that God did not change the day. If it did, it would say first instead of seventh. I saw that the Pope changed the day. And then a little on she said, I saw that the Sabbath was the great question to unite God's dear waiting saints. And then she spoke about going out and proclaiming the Sabbath more fully. And she wrote this all out in a letter on Wednesday and sent it to Joseph Bates, who, as I say, got it printed, and you can read it today. Some originals are still present of that. Now listen. When Sister White, who was already a Sabbath keeper, was given her first vision on the Sabbath question, where was she taken? Was she taken to creation and shown Jesus keeping the first Sabbath? No. Was she taken to Mount Sinai and shown God proclaiming the Sabbath commandment? No. Was she taken to Nazareth and shown Jesus going to the synagogue as his custom was? No. Where was she taken? To the heavenly sanctuary. Jesus in the most holy place. Now, was this realization that Jesus had gone into the most holy place where the Ten Commandments are? Jesus had gone there. They were all concerned about Jesus. Why hadn't Jesus come? What is Jesus doing? Jesus is marrying the kingdom. Jesus is doing judgment. And now they saw Jesus is holding up to the world in a whole new way the Ten Commandments. And the fourth commandment, he has put a halo of glory around. He, Jesus, now, in the most holy place, is calling on us to keep the Sabbath. Now. And this is what was the motivation that made our pioneers Sabbath keepers. The other folks who began to keep the Sabbath for a little while, learning it from the Seventh-day Baptists and others, but rejecting what happened in 1844, gave up the Sabbath. Practically none of them. Just a very, very few Church of God people that still keep the Sabbath without the sanctuary from those early days. But the dynamic of the Sabbath and the Seventh-day Adventist movement comes from 1844. Because, you see, let me add this. 1844, the hour of his judgment, it comes the first angel's message. And the first angel's message is followed by the second, which says, Babylon's fallen. Look out! And the third angel's message warns those who don't keep the Sabbath that they'll get the mark of the beast if they don't change and follow God's will. But praise his name, those who have faith in Jesus and keep the commandments are honored as the saints. There's a dynamic in the Seventh-day Adventist Sabbath understanding that nobody else has. The Seventh-day Baptists from whom we got the Sabbath today have about 30,000 members. They've never grown particularly. That's in the world. Seventh-day Adventists have 8 million. There's got to be some difference, brother. The dynamic, the seal of God, the mark of the beast, Jesus in the most holy place. It's time now to keep the Sabbath and tell everybody about it. Time is running out. Keep the Sabbath. The temple of God has been opened in heaven and the Ark of His Covenant has been seen. And this is why our Sabbath, under God's grace, has a greater dynamics because of 1844. Our whole call to holy living in preparation for the second coming, which involves the Sabbath as a reminder that God sanctifies, is linked to what Jesus did in heaven in 1844. It's Christ-centered, linked to Jesus just as much as to the cross because of what Jesus did in heaven in 1844. Did you follow me? That's the idea. Okay. I'm going to have to let you go because time is up. If any of you want to stay and ask me questions, you certainly may. And let's bow our heads and say a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you very much for loving us. Thank you for telling us what Jesus is doing in heaven today. Please help us to live as though we really did believe it and loved it and honor Him. And bless this weekend. May we truly see Jesus here at the William Miller Farm for Jesus' sake. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.